It's time for Let's Talk Money.
Good afternoon, Chattanooga. This is Let's Talk Money with Jamie O'Donnell and Jim Place. 267-1023 is the number. Starting our market day, Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 126 points, sitting at 32,936. S&P down 3, sitting at 4,134. Jim, how are you?
I'm doing fine, but Max, I got a complaint. Are you ready?
Okay.
This happens way too often. It happened this morning again. I'm talking to somebody that all of a sudden they go, oh, your daughter's Jamie. She does such a good job on radio. And I'm thinking, what the hell am I, chopped liver?
Sorry.
You started this while you were thinking about her.
Really?
I'm telling you.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, she's having her 13th birthday, and I'm doing radio. But
yeah.
Maybe you just need to try harder.
apparently I do.
Oh.
All right. With us today, Jim Catanzaro with Chandler, Spawner & Staple. Jim, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me today.
Yeah. Glad to have you here. We're going to do a topic that I don't think we've really spent much of any time at all covering on the show. And we're going to be talking about nonprofits, what they are, what you should be looking for from the donor perspective, what if you want to start one, all those different things. But let's start with the basics, Jim. What is a nonprofit? What makes it different than any other business out there?
It's a great question. And there are a lot of folks who have a misunderstanding. They take the term nonprofit and they say, well, that means no profits. Actually, no, that's not correct. What makes it different is there isn't, at the end of the day, an owner or a shareholder who takes a part of that profit as a dividend or distribution. There are no shareholders. Actually, the assets of a nonprofit are indirectly owned by the citizens of the state of Tennessee, and they're, through their trustees or directors, used for the benefit of a charitable purpose. So all of the profits would go back into then the operations and the purpose of the organization that's charitable.
But I do think that's a good distinguishing factor, because I do think that the no-profit misconception is there. But I know in all my experience with nonprofits, there's absolutely, I don't want to call it a profit motive, but we did want to make money to do more of whatever it was the objective was for that particular organization. What about different types? Because a lot of times you hear the 501c3, and that's really just a reference to a tax code section. There are other types of nonprofits, but I think that's the one everybody thinks about.
No, that's a great point. There are, and I'm going to try not to get hyper-technical, but there are actually 26 subsections of 501c organizations. The C3 is the only organization that has both a charitable purpose and through which charitable donations can be made. You know, we all know that when we give a gift to a 501c3, we get a receipt and we then get to deduct that amount from our taxable income. Any other C organization, though, like a C6, which is a civic organization or league, for example, there are C4s that are socially minded organizations, but although their income is tax exempt, contributions made by any third party would not be deductible, actually. So there are the different kinds under the tax code, and then there are actually different types of charities this way, which there are public charities. Think of something perhaps like the Red Cross, where there are services that are generated in public donors, and then there are private foundations. We know endowments at universities and other organizations where there is either a sale of a business or maybe a one-time very generous contribution, and then a single fund only through which there's support through the income off of that corpus that drives whatever donations they want to make.
But if I'm a C3, the only way that an individual is going to be able to give me money in a nonprofit that would potentially be deductible to me would be C3.
Correct. That's right.
And that's the reason you hear what you hear 99.9% of the time is 501c3.
Exactly. Yep.
Explain to me, when you talk about the private versus public 501c3, is that distinguishment primarily made by how the assets are given on the front end? Because you alluded to the one-time donation. they can't collect ongoing contributions? Is it, does it have to be a one-time, like an endowment, and they're not continuing to raise money?
They can continue to raise money. What's different, of course, in most cases, the true private foundation endowment, they're not going to render services. They're primarily going to take income driven from the investment of the corpus, the body of the endowment, and they'll fund other public charities from that money.
Would that be a Lyndhurst?
Exactly.
Something of that nature?
Yes. Great example.
They're not really... You know, I'm not donating to Lyndhurst.
Right. Most donors would look at that and say, hey, you got plenty of money. You know, we don't need to. Now, they might apply for, some might apply for grants to supplement what they might do. But by and large, I think your distinction, Jim, is the right one, which is that that's not what you're going to have with a private foundation. Now, a public charity might be, take, for example, a hospital, right? You're billing, you know, federal governmental programs. You're fundraising. I mean, that fundraising comes from any number of sources, government funds, private grants like a Lyndhurst, or just individual gifts.
If you're an individual from a donor's perspective, there are a lot of nonprofits out there. They're
very true.
I'm going to go with there's good ones and there's not so good ones, and there might even be some bad ones. What do you do to make that evaluation? Say, let's say your passion is animals, and there are hundreds of thousands of organizations out there that are set up as nonprofits with that being their objective. How do you evaluate amongst those?
Let me add on to that. Would you go to like a Chattanooga Foundation for that?
You could. I will tell you, there are a couple different sources. To answer your question, I'll start there and we'll drill down to the foundations as a potential resource also. There are a couple websites. One in particular is called Charity Navigator. There's another called GuideStar, and they rank charities based primarily on public filings. They gather their information, including their tax information returns. Charities, you may or may not know, but have to file, not, of course, because they're not paying taxes, but they do file information returns called Form 990. Those Form 990s are publicly available. They're collected by a place like GuideStar or Charity Navigator, and they're ranked based on various disclosures through that form, including how much of their assets are actually going for charitable programs, as opposed to are these donations being used to fund maybe excessive compensation or not properly managed. Right. And you can begin to see and sort of sort through the organizations, like in your example for, you know, animals, care of animals. Well, this one here seems like it's really well managed. And then also look at the impacts. Right. We can see the impacts created. And that might also be something that's amplified, Jim, to your question earlier about foundations. What are the impacts that they're interested in seeing? And if they fund those organizations, If the private foundations fund them, then you can know they've gone through a very rigorous grant application process. So they're probably doing things very, very well.
Now, you can see, and you can see some pretty significant discrepancy. I go back, I think, several years ago to the earthquakes in Haiti, where a couple of these large foundation, these entities that were put together, when they filed, was it at Form 990?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 10 or 15% of the money raised was going towards the charitable cause, and 85% of it was going to infrastructure and salaries.
That's right.
We didn't begin to touch or do anywhere near what it said it was going to do, and it was one of the ones that was advertised on TV every day with president, ex-president sitting out there saying, give to this, and you find out there wasn't much real giving going on.
Exactly, right. And that's the important thing that you really can sort of pick up from those websites is, okay, you know, let's see what's really going to program or end uses, because that's where I want my dollars going. The other thing you can do as a donor, by the way, is let's say that you find a couple different sources that you want to contribute to, or one in particular that you really find meets your need, you can designate your gift. You can restrict it to a particular use. And that way, instead of a general gift, which goes into the general operating fund and might go to salaries or administrative costs, you might say, I want this going to, you know, the construction of a building in a capital project, or to a particular use. and they are obligated really by contractual law to follow through with that.
That was going to be my question. Does a charity, are they required to accept restricted gifts?
They can turn them away.
Okay.
But oftentimes, of course, they're not going to want to, depending on how generous it is. Sometimes there may be so many conditions that are placed on a restriction where they might say, well, I'm sorry, we can't, you know, we can't agree to those terms, or we can't carry out what you wish. But by and large, I think you can have the discussion, especially as a significant donor. You can really work with a management team to say, here's what we want to see. By the way, here's what we want to see in terms of impact. So we want to see your annual reports and your reporting match up with that.
Are there any rules of thumb as to what percentage should be really going to benefits to versus compensation and expenses and things like that? Or is it dependent on what the particular organization does?
Yeah, it's really kind of the latter. There's a general rule of thumb, but I would tell you, you can, like a lot of things, you know, it's very case or fact specific. So in some cases, what I would give you is this viewpoint. If the organization is in a mode where it's building up to start new programs, well, some of those dollars are going to go towards that developmental side. And so while you might not have the impact year one, you might really be scaling up so that you're going to see it in years two and three. You know, again, in terms of the restrictions that apply, you can manage and work with management of where those dollars go so that you're ensuring that we're not overdoing it here, which is simply, you know, fat cats putting more dollars into their pockets.
267-1023 is the number. This Let's Talk Money. We'll be right back.
Let's Talk Money. Talk Radio 102.3.
We're back with Let's Talk Money. 267-1023 is the number. With us today, Jim Catanzaro with Chambliss Bonner and Stoeffel. Let's go to the phone lines. Hi, Gary. How are you?
Hey, doing fine. I had a quick question. Just to talk about nonprofits, I know we have Memorial Hospital, which is nonprofit. I saw Erlanger says they're going to become or applying to become a nonprofit. Why? What's the advantage to Erlanger to do that and the disadvantage? And what does that mean for the county who's been funding a lot of Erlanger's facility? What does that mean, good or bad, for the county and care for people in the county and for county?
Thank you, Gary. That's an excellent question. Jim, I'll let you address it.
I do know a little bit of the background. I don't know all of the specifics in terms of the strategy, but from an outside perspective, a couple things kind of pop up to me right off the bat. You know, currently Erlanger, of course, is the Chattanooga-Hamilton County Hospital Authority. It is a public but governmental body.
Okay.
As a result, there are state constitutional and other limitations that apply. So from the jump, the conversion to a private nonprofit will remove those limitations. So I would expect that what you'd hear from maybe the trustees there or the management team is, hey, this will allow us to be more competitive. I think from a cynical side, and I'm not suggesting this is right off the bat, but it sure also would position them to sell the assets of the hospital down the road if that were strategically beneficial. I know there are, from reading news articles like you all, that there are limitations they've agreed to, I think, with the county and the city, which would restrict their ability to do that for some period of time. I can't remember what that time period is. Frankly, it's a couple years. But even so, long term, that would be something that they could consider and do. One other thing that they'll not have to comply with, of course, would be all the Sunshine Act requirements, open meetings, of course, open records. So there's some flexibility, and then there's the ability, of course, too, to maybe wall off some of their decision-making and not have it just be immediately available to the press and the public.
So there could be some potential positives, some potential negatives, and that'll play out over time.
Yes. I imagine they had a strategy in mind with this and some objectives that they wanted to go ahead and achieve.
Some of which may be public, some of which may not.
Very, Very true. Yes, exactly. So, well, so you're right, Jamie. Over time, we'll get to see some of that play out. We'll go, aha. So that was one of those goals.
If Memorial was nonprofit, is Park Ridge a nonprofit as well?
Park Ridge is not.
Okay.
Yeah, they're part of the HGA system, and they're for-profit.
Okay. That's my own ignorance there.
No. it's so hard to tell, and I'll be honest with you. One of the interesting things, especially with healthcare providers, is the blurring of the difference between a nonprofit healthcare provider and a for-profit in this sense, which is I think while you would still find more compassionate care rendered at a nonprofit, the ability to compete and obtain payer contracts with especially the big insurance companies like a Blue Cross Blue Shield or others, you have to have covered lives that you're providing services to. That means, you know, profits and retained earnings. It means competitive in terms of recruiting doctors. It then begins to really blur the difference between the operations of a for-profit and a not-for-profit, even though there's no shareholder involved in, obviously, the not-for-profit side.
One last question relative to donors and tax deductions. The 501c3 part is important. That's the only type of organization that's going to allow you to deduct that contribution. What are my rules, or what do I need to do as an individual? I'm going to give $25,000 to ABC organization. What do I have to do to document that? And does it change as to whether I'm giving cash or maybe I'm giving a piece of equipment, mm-hmm. a physical something or other? What are the rules for me so that the IRS will accept that?
And I know one other thing, because we had this conversation a few weeks ago on the show. I've got to get something from it that said there was no, I didn't get anything for it.
Right. Right.
We were talking about a gal that lost a $385,000 tax deduction.
Right.
It was in Arizona and had to do with Indian art because she didn't get, what's the letter called? You know, the letter that.
Yeah, some sort of authorization.
Yes, it's the acknowledgement of the receipt and the deductibility of the contribution.
When do these things come into play? If I'm given $50, does that matter? It obviously mattered for this lady who gave $380,000 or whatever, and she was not able. It ended up going to tax court, and she could not take the deduction.
Right, and I'll mention a couple high level things. Remember, we mentioned the private foundation and the public charity.
Yes.
So there are different deductibility caps for those two kinds of organization. So you have a lower amount. It's a percentage of your adjusted gross income.
Mm-hmm.
And the amounts are lower for private foundations. Again, the assumption being, well, you've already got millions of dollars.
Yes.
Versus the public charity where you're needing public sources and you have higher caps. And then they're different based on whether you're giving cash or whether you're giving property. To your point a moment ago, Jim, whether you're if you're providing property, especially if you're receiving anything in return, what the IRS requires is that you're netting the two.
Yeah, that you're subtracting one from the other.
Exactly.
And they require that signed form whether you did or didn't. In this particular case, the woman received nothing.
Yeah.
Still didn't get the deduction because it had to be done in a certain time frame.
That's right. There's that, and so any donor, back to your question, Jamie, I think whether it's $50 or whether it's $380,000, you need to be very careful about the receipt documentation that you're getting. I would tell you, especially with property, those are the trickiest questions mm-hmm. in terms of how you're valuing the property and then the overall contribution. You really need to work with your accountant if you have one. There are other sources that you can reach out to and seek some sort of guidance because many of the nonprofits are not fully versed in the rules either.
That was going to be my follow-up question to you, Jim, is can you rely on the nonprofit's guidance?
In many cases, the answer would be yes, but you need to have a healthy skepticism. And in some cases, you're going to want to immediately, if you can, find that consultant who can help you say, okay, let's first talk about what the rule is, what the cap is on your contribution, what you really can properly deduct. And then what is the value? Where do we come up with the value of the property?
Do we need an appraisal? Do we need a valuation of some sort?
Yes, exactly. And your really well-run charities should have that discussion with you so you're not having to come up with all this. But not all of them are going to. So I think, you know, for our listeners or anybody out there, it would be, I think, incumbent upon you simply to ask the question, well, what else do I need to do to make sure that I'm taking the proper amount of a deduction here? And if you're not getting much in the way of an answer with, you know, with whom you're dealing, then you need to either find somebody else at the charity who does provide you some good information, or you need immediately to decide with your accountant, okay, under these circumstances, am I creating any sort of risk or exposure tax-wise by making this donation? Am I somehow going to be disallowed if this is audited?
Well, and I think, too, I mean, I know I can think of some wonderful organizations in town that are simple and they're doing great work, but they're smaller organizations and they are not in a position to give tax advice of any sort. It doesn't mean they're not a great organization.
Right.
They're just not in that space that way.
You better have outside people helping you in that particular case.
I think so. And for some people, it might be that you flip the tables on the charity and say, hey, to the extent I want to make this, we got to make sure it's right. And so you pay for and seek the consulting and the guidance. And then we'll all be sure that we're doing this correctly.
That's a really good point. Yeah. Flip sides here. Let's talk about starting a nonprofit. Why would you start your own? How do you make the decision as to what type to start? Would you be better off giving through community foundations, something else? What are all those different considerations?
That's a great question. So many people, I think, have a passion for a particular cause or a service. They see that there's a need. But what I would tell a lot of folks is, you know, you mentioned a moment ago, we have so many here in Chattanooga. Mm-hmm. I mean, Chattanooga is such a wonderful community that way. We have such a giving community. But because of that, there are many people that don't even understand the service is already being provided through this other charity.
Yes.
So I think that's step one, which is, you know, maybe talk with the folks at the United Way, for example, who deal with a lot of these different kinds of charities.
You're almost talking about a feasibility study.
Yes. That's a good way to put it, right? Which is take a look and decide, is it worth my time and effort? Because it costs money. And by the way, once I get this thing operational, unlike a for-profit, I don't own it. I don't get a return on my investment.
Right.
Right.
And there's ongoing costs, like that Form 990, among many other things that have to be done.
Exactly. There's ongoing costs, commitment. And at the end of the day, all of your contributions, unless you make a loan to the organization, you might do that, or you might loan the money. If you're truly contributing the dollars, most people do that, right? You don't see those dollars again coming back to you. The assets that are purchased or acquired, well, even if you dissolve the organization, they go to another 501c3. They're required to. So these are, the important kind of considerations right out of the gate. Do you have someone else providing the service? Is it worth your time and effort to really put into fill the gap, so to speak?
Mm-hmm.
Then beyond that, I think once you decide that that's truly something that you want to do, as you mentioned a moment ago, I think it's a great point. Well, what about the community foundation? If I really have a modest amount of money that I want to give, and yet I want to be impactful about where I give it and how I give it, the community foundation is a wonderful resource that way.
Mm-hmm.
I can get my tax deduction. They're a 501c3. They're called a donor advised fund.
Mm-hmm.
And you can then say, here's what I want to do with my money, community foundation. And then they can, in many cases, find, like, do the due diligence that you mentioned, Jim, for you, and find the organizations that fit that. And you say, well, okay, so here's what I now want to do. I want to source this to charities X, Y, and Z. And so you might be able to accomplish your goal that way versus hey, no, I have a true service I want to render, and it requires organization, or it requires a foundation because I have enough money that I want to put into an endowment-like kind of fund that I, in perpetuity, am going to create this fund that continues to benefit Chattanooga, or I'm going to create an organization as a public charity that renders this valuable service.
I don't want this to sound negative, but do we have too much overlap among nonprofit? And I'm going to limit us to Chattanooga right now. Let's not look countrywide. Let's just talk about Chattanooga. Could dollars be more effectively used if we had less organizations?
Yes. My opinion is I think I agree with that statement. I think to a certain extent, objectively, you can take a look at the landscape and you see very similar services.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, why not combine these organizations? There are limited resources that are out there, only so many donors in our Chattanooga area, even though we're very generous as a community. There are only so many personal donors, only so many foundations, only so many government funds that are available in any given year. So, you know, why create another, right? Why not simply gift to one that currently exists, restrict your gift even to a new program, and go that route? So those are all great questions, I think, because in general, I think just running out and starting an organization contributes to the issue you're talking about, was we just add another, and we create this kind of additional mouth to feed. Is it worthwhile? Well, they're already duplicating all these other services that are offered in, you know, these other charities. Why do that?
Let's say we have a situation where the service that the individual wants to provide is truly unique, and there is a good reason to start a new foundation. What are you looking at cost-wise?
Yeah, I break it down this way. There are, of course, the filing costs that you're going to incur. They're governmental fees. You know, and so you're setting up a Tennessee nonprofit corporation. That's a pretty cheap cost there. It's about $100 with the Tennessee Secretary of State. Ultimately, you're going to file step two if you want to become a C3, what's called a 1023, a form 1023 with the IRS. That's the application for exempt status. It's a $600 filing fee in general. Now, you need, many people will seek out and will use LegalZoom and other resources like that to try to form their own. And more power to some folks, they're able to create some basic structure. I would tell you, though, that if you're looking, and nonprofits are complex.
Yeah.
There are many, you know, bells and whistles that go with it. You really need the guidance of somebody who's an experienced consultant or advisor. And so you're looking at spending a couple thousand dollars there in terms of fees to get yourself going. So what I tell folks there is, make sure you know who's going to be on your board. Make sure you know who's committed to your particular purpose and can provide the gifts that get you off the ground. Otherwise, you're looking at fronting as the single incorporator all those dollars that go to whether it's lawyers or CPAs and then the funding fees. You may never get that back.
267-1023 is the number. This Let's Talk Money. We'll be right back.
Let's Talk Money. Talk Radio 102.3.
We're back with Let's Talk Money. 267-1023 is the number. With us today, Jim Catanzaro with Chambliss, Bonner & Stoeffel. Jim, we're going to start the nonprofit. All right, here's a big aspect of nonprofits, and they can't really exist without them. Let's talk about boards, why you need them, what they do. And for all of you that have been on boards, you know, do you say yes? Do you say no? What are you getting yourself into?
Yeah, that's such a critical question. Ultimately, the board, by law, is responsible for the charitable operations and really the use of the assets to pursue that kind of purpose or mission. So when you ask yourself, do I want to do this, that's really probably the first question to ask yourself, which is,
Is a board almost like the executor of the will?
Yeah, it's similar, right? You are what's called a fiduciary.
Yes.
So exactly to your point. So you know, a fiduciary is I'm essentially looking after the property of someone else. And in this case, you're looking at all the constituents and really the people of the state of Tennessee who might use your services. And so you're a fiduciary on behalf of those people. So that, I think that's the first, you know, question, which is, am I ready for that responsibility?
Yes.
And, you know, just basically, of course, when you talk about a board, you're talking about a group of from, you know, anywhere from three to, you know, any number of people. There are some really large boards here in some organizations in town. Some of them are 25, 30, or even 75 or 100. I don't like those larger ones, by the way.
That's too many in my humble opinion, but whatever.
Exactly. But the typical, you're probably talking about somewhere from 9 to 13.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you have a chair and other officers like a secretary, a treasurer, and a vice chair. And each of those directors is charged with, you know, operating the organization, but really they do that through the selection of an executive director or a president.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably the most important role of the board, is selecting that executive director or president to run the day-to-day. And that relationship then is you're creating accountability as the board with that particular executive director or president. Hey, what are you doing? What are the plans? Are we on budget? Are we off budget? All those kind of critical questions about what's really going on with our charitable assets.
Can we look at it kind of similar to in the for-profit world? You have a large corporation. They have a board, and then you have the CEO that actually runs the company.
Exactly. It's the same structure and same format. The only difference is, you know, you have shareholders who elect directors. So, you know, directors in a for-profit represent the shareholders' interest.
Mm-hmm.
In the nonprofit, of course, you have, in some cases, you can have members of a nonprofit. It's confusing. But many cases, you don't have members. But the members might elect the directors. But in most cases, you have what's the self-perpetuating board, meaning the board appoints its own members. And in that case, you might want to think about term limits and other considerations so you don't have, you know, someone there for 30 years in a particular board situation when really the idea is you're supposed to be representing the interests of the community, so we need new voices and new blood from time to time.
I think that's a very important part of any organization like that. And I think most of the good ones would have those rules in place. You're asked or approached to be on a board. Number one question I agree with you for yourself is, I understand that this is a fiduciary role and I'm willing to do this. I would add more of a touchy-feely one of, do I believe in this project? Is this something I actually care about? Because while I may not be giving money, I'm giving time.
No, that's a fantastic point. I think you have to have that passion for that organization's mission. Really to want to volunteer all
yes.
of the time. And of course, in many cases, too, to be a board member, the organizations are asking the board to contribute.
Yes.
And because it's difficult for the organization to go to other donors and say, you know, I want you to give, even though our board members don't believe enough in our mission that they all give. So it's very important in some cases to go and say, we have 100% board giving. So we're all in. You should be, too. But you're exactly right in terms of that question about passion, because if you're not really passionate about it, then you're not going to go to the meetings. And if you don't go to the meetings, you don't educate yourself because you don't care enough about it, then you can't make informed decisions and you really can't function well as a board member.
Well, and fortunately or unfortunately, a percentage of the time you have a board that's looking to perpetuate, is out there looking for rich people to be on their board.
Yes. Yes.
And it may be a person with a lot of money that's willing to give money, but not necessarily interested in doing the work or the job that you would need to be responsible for doing on the board. So that's a double-edged sword.
It really is. You know, you're so right. I think one of the overlooked concerns about nonprofits is what I call onboarding of directors. Who is it that you want on your board? Who do you need? I like to think of it this way, which is it from a couple different perspectives. One is we want some reflective ability of our community, you know, or our users. We want some of that voice. Then we need skill sets. Mm-hmm. We might need somebody with a legal background. We might need somebody with insurance. We might need somebody with a banking background, mm-hmm. and on and on. So there needs to be this intentionality around building an effective board. Otherwise, to your point, Jim, what you're going to have is you're going to say, well, we really want to get, you know, X amount of dollars. So-and-so is going to pony up. Let's get that person. Well, maybe they never show. Or maybe when they do show, they're totally disengaged. Or they just don't have the skill sets available on your board. So now what do you do? What kind of decision-making are you getting?
267-1023 is the number. This Let's Talk Money. We'll be right back.
Let's Talk Money. Talk Radio 102.3.
We're back with Let's Talk Money. 267-1023 is the number with us today. Jim Catanzaro with Chambliss, Bonner & Stoeffel. Jim, we were talking about board members. What about conflicts of interest? I mean, I know we operate as fiduciaries, and with fiduciaries comes that three-word saying, conflicts of interest.
Right.
How do those come into play on boards?
You know, in many cases, in the negative side,
mm-hmm.
You might have a director who would, say, own a business that could be a potential vendor to that particular charity. And that board member might use the influence of being on both sides of that transaction to really put the charity into a vendor relationship that maybe overpays for the service,
You could have a contractor sitting on a board, and you hire that. You're hiring that contractor to build your building.
Exactly. And in those kind of cases, there can be clearly this abuse, right? Which is, I am facilitating because I can control it. Dollars basically being put into my own pocket. Now contrast that with the beneficial side, because the other side of it is, you know, in many cases, like we mentioned a moment ago, boards that are well-run will bring on many skill sets,
mm-hmm.
because they're going to want to leverage those. Let's take this the same situation where maybe the vendor says, hey, I can provide this service or the property or the item to you at below market rates.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is in the best interest of the organization. That's a great deal for them, and they're going to want to leverage that, right? So as long as you go through the right process in that situation, which is, okay, we've excluded this person from voting. They can't influence our independent directors. We can make our own assessment, and we look at it. Maybe we look at other bids, or we look at
other
proposals.
We document that.
Exactly. Then we can show this really is in the best interest of the organization, so let's vote it without that other person involved.
Well, there would be a difference. I mean, if you're sitting on a board and you're an attorney with Chambliss, and you're on that board partly because of your legal background, and you're offering them free advice. Now that board's got a particular situation where they're looking for a law firm. It's not that you're not saying you couldn't do it or
no,
your firm
it,
couldn't do it, but it's got to be disclosed. You don't want to be voting on it, and you want it to be as separate as it possibly can be.
Jim, thank you. Enjoyed it. Coming up next, the Ramsey Show, 1 to 3, 3 to 7, Sport Talk. We'll talk to you.